Good afternoon. I'm going to open the House Committee on Education. It's the Subcommittee on Education Innovation. Today is February 6th. It's just a little bit after 1. Welcome to all my colleagues and the people in the audience today. Today we're going to do a public hearing on just one bill. And I am going to open the public hearing on House Bill 2037. We have a few people signed up to share about the bill, but we're going to start out with our committee administrator, Rick Rakobian, to tell us about the bill, and then we'll follow up with our next presenters.
Thank you, Chair. House Bill 2037 basically deletes a provision that was put in ORS 338-125 in 2005. Senate Bill 1071 actually placed a provision in there that stated that if a public charter school offers any online courses, it had to have at least 50% of its students reside in that district. This bill would delete that provision. Basically, that's it. This bill does have a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. There's a probably would be one of the primary, I think perhaps right now the only maybe school in Oregon right now is the Oregon Connections Academy that is impacted by this. I think it reportedly has about 1,200 students, most of them residing outside of this SIO school district where its authority resides. That's it, Chair. Thank you.
Thank you. I asked a colleague of mine that she's the guru about charter schools, and I don't know if she realizes that, but we all highly respect her. Joni Gillis, she works at the Oregon Department of Education, to kind of give us a little bit of history about charter schools and how many students we have attending those, and just give us a foundation for our discussion today. So I just asked her this 5 minutes ago, so don't ask her any tough questions yet.
I'm sure just to confirm, do we have to address her as Guru Gillis, or is it
revered colleague? We'll do it.
All right.
Joni, if you'd say your name for the record and share us just a little information.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Joni Gillis. I'm with the Department of Education, and I am here to just give you a brief overview of the charter school activity in Oregon since the law was enacted in May of 1999. Currently, we have 70 charter schools that are operating, and they're educating over 9,000 students in the state. They're located in 44 school districts and 23 counties. Charter schools in Oregon, they're really as diverse as the communities in which they serve. We have charter schools that are developed by internally by school districts and also by outside groups. We have them in rural areas and urban areas. The curriculum, as like I said, is diverse as the communities in which they're located. We have Waldorf online classes. We have credit deficiency, Montessori, military academy. So it's really an interesting mix of educational opportunities for students. I do have a catalog of our 2006-2007 charter schools, so you can, and I'll make sure that you get all of those. I thought because this discussion is particular to online charter schools or charter schools that offer online courses, we have 6 of those that are operating in the state. We have Oregon Connections Academy. They're our largest, and they have about 1,507 students. 10 of those are from the sponsoring district. The remaining are from districts throughout the rest of the state. We have Oregon Virtual School. That's located in Bend La Pine. They have 34 full-time and 103 part-time students. All of those are from their from the Bend La Pine district.
What was that figure again, Joni? 3,400?
34 full-time students and 103 part-time. We have Lincoln City Career Tech High. That's located in Lincoln County School District. Actually, they just have 4 students that are taking online classes. Clackamas Web Academy, that's located in North Clackamas School District. They have 404 students. 202 of those are from the North Clackamas School District, and 202 are from other districts around the state.
50%.
West Lane Technical Learning Center has 100 students. That's located in Fern Ridge School District. 43 of those are from Fern Ridge, and they have 57 that are located from other districts in the state. And the last one is Resource Link Charter School, located in Coos Bay. They have 50 students, 45 are from the Coos Bay School District, and 5 are from other districts. So that kind of gives you an idea of the charter schools that serve, have online courses, and I would be willing to answer any questions. Do you have any?
Okay, yeah, I think there's a couple bubbling. Representative Cannon?
And thank you, Madam Chair. Could you give the numbers for the first school, the one inside of Oregon Connections Academy again, please?
Certainly. Representative Comp, Representative Cannon, for the Oregon Connections Academy that's located in SIO, there's 1,507 students that they have. 10 of those are from the sponsoring school district from SIO, and the remaining 1,497 would be from other districts throughout the state.
Can I follow up, please? Perhaps you or someone else who's testifying can clarify how the SIO district is able under current law to enroll 98% of its students in that school from outside the district.
Do you feel comfortable with answering that, Joni?
I think I would ask my colleague Randy Harnish to come.
Okay,
that would
be
also
great. Representative Dahlem, did you have a question while Randy comes up? Okay.
I think I may have follow-ups here. I think we're in the same area.
Okay. Randy, when you state your name for the record, would you make sure you spell it so we get it correctly for the record?
Certainly. Randy Harnish, that's H-A-R-N-I-S-C-H, with the Department of Education. And Chair Comp, Representative Cannon, my understanding is that the passage of this legislation in 05 came after the existence of the contract with the SIO school district and the charter sponsor, and it was the belief that during the period of this contractual period that the law would not apply, that it would apply subsequently on renewal of the contract.
Okay. Anything else, Representative Cannon?
Let me think.
You're thinking?
It.
Okay. Representative Dahlem?
First, I'm not sure where I fit on this, Madam Chair, and if the administrator would check. At the closing of the last session, I had no particular association with the Oregon Academy, but I do now. My daughter works there as a teacher. So I would ask the administrator to check my status. I think I have to declare that. That may be a conflict. No, that is a conflict. What I'd like to ask is, with the Connections Academy, would they have to comply with the 50% rule in the future, or are they grandfathered in perpetuity?
Chair Comp, Representative Dahlem, my understanding, and again, this question hasn't been posed to us formally, although it appears that it has been now. My understanding is that the contract period, I believe, was for 5 years.
Uh-huh.
And our understanding was that the legislation would not apply during that five-year period, that it would apply upon renewal.
Follow up, if I may, Madam Chair.
Absolutely.
In reading the Statesman Journal, Gene Evans of your office implied that there's an Attorney General's opinion, or perhaps even a letter from the Attorney General that clarifies this matter. I don't want you to comment on the newspaper articles, but even without the conflict of interest, I'm very interested in that. Is there an Attorney General's opinion as to the position that you've just stated?
Chair Comp and Representative Dahlem, not to my knowledge.
Okay. Thank you. It seems to imply there is. Would you check at ODE? And if there is, could we get a copy of that for all of the members
certainly
of the committee?
We appreciate it. Representative Roblin?
A couple questions, if it's okay.
Please, okay. Just go right ahead.
Number one, with regard, and we'll stay with the connections school questions. Is it high school or K through 12? Do we know? Yes.
Chair Comp, Representative Rowland, it is a K-10.
K-10.
Presently, yes.
Okay. And so there are different requirements for the amount of money that the school district can keep as opposed to the sending it through to the school district. Do you know in their arrangement if they have kept the statutory amount, which would be 95-85, or...
Chair Comp, Representative Rowland, it is my understanding that the contract is for 90%, so it's kind of right in the middle between the 80 and 95%.
Yeah. Our microphones are real sensitive, so just sitting the way you are.
Okay.
There you go. Just relax. No, you're fine.
And so that is 90% of what amount? What's the total, what's the amount this last year that we gave for school per student? You know?
Average?
Yeah.
Chair Comp, Representative Rowland, I need to check exactly on those figures. It would be 90% of the weighted ADM that SIO district would receive, and we could check on that pretty quickly.
Okay.
Can I follow up
sure.
on that? Yes, following up on Representative Rowland, is that, now, if we had a student enrolled for a single class, for example, an English class, they get... there's a formula for that so that they get 90% of the fraction of the time they're enrolled. So we'd have to know if they're full-time equivalents or if they are part-time, wouldn't we, to get some notion of how much money the academy might be getting.
Chair Comp, Representative Dahlem, we could very quickly get the information on the state school funding. I don't have that. Somebody from the school might have that, however, the district that is here today, but I don't have that. But we could get it to you fairly quickly.
Representative Dahlem, to clarify, are you asking how much student funding they're receiving per student or...
Well, anyway,
class, or
when we talk about 1,497 students,
correct.
I think it's imperative that we know how many of those are one class,
right,
half time, full time, because it creates there might be a difference in what's paid for, and simply stating the number,
right?
They're there for a period, but are they there for a full period for funding? And I don't want to confuse period. That means they're there for a time, but it may simply be a period of instruction.
Right. Okay.
Chair Comp, Representative Dahlem, the majority of students at Oregon Connections Academy are full-time students. They're not there just for one or two classes. So, I think the majority are.
Thank you.
Representative Roblin.
Thank you again, Madam Chair. And I won't defer to him next time. Yeah, we're getting in trouble again.
Well, yeah, the tag team needs to cease
right.
and desist.
So I appreciate it. Yeah, thanks. And my question has to do with when you're getting those numbers, it would be nice to know if the 1,507 is the number of actual students and what the weighted ADM would be as well, because it would be interesting for me to know that.
Yes. Well, I'd like to hear from the department.
Okay.
Yeah. Do you know what kind of a timeline, tomorrow or the next day, or?
Madam Chair, I think we could have it this afternoon or tomorrow morning.
That'd be great.
It would be pretty quick to pull together.
Yeah, I know it wouldn't take long. Okay, thank you.
Sure. Could I ask one more question of Mr. Harnish before he leaves?
Absolutely.
Randy, on the last night of the session, or maybe that was two nights, I don't remember, or maybe it was most of my life. It seemed like a long time in a short number of hours. But I talked to several people and talked about grandfathering, and I'm sure that I was concerned about the 50% rule then, and assured that it was a grandfather for this particular school. Because I believe distance learning has a place in education, but where would the notion that the grandfather would simply be for the length of the charter? I thought it would be. It was clear to me that it would be for the duration of that school's history. As I was on the House floor that night, talking with those. In fact, I believe I stood up and spoke in favor of the legislation, but with the understanding that that academy would be grandfathered in perpetuity.
Representative Comp and Representative Dahlem, again, my understanding, I wasn't there. My understanding was kind of as being part of a conversation that led up to the discussion around the contractual issue. And at least my understanding was that we were talking only about the period of the contract. Now, as far as conversations that may have occurred outside of my, you know, outside of me, I really can't speak to.
If I could, Madam Chair, I do believe that the intent in those discussions was for the life of the school. It wasn't just for a contract period, but that particular school district. I was the speaker at the time, so that was part of the discussion that the Sile School District would be grandfathered in because this was a new law after they've existed. That was our understanding in the discussions.
Sounds like a research project. Okay. Well, thank you for giving us a little bit of foundation for our presentation today, Joni Gillis and Randy Harnish.
Thank you
so much. At this time, Stephen Kapore, would you come forward and give us your testimony, please?
Thank you, Madam Chair, member of the committee. My name is Stephen Kapore. I'm here today representing Apollo Group. Apollo Group is the parent corporation for the University of Phoenix. I know that at least a couple of people on the committee have been out there and seen the University of Phoenix. And I wanted to say that I think the University of Phoenix represents to me the best in what private for-profit education can be. I know a lot of people have a feeling that private for-profit and high-quality education, you can't put them in the same sentence, but I've seen it work for a number of years, and the national model works well. Apollo Group, the parent corporation for University of Phoenix, has just recently purchased a company called Insight Schools. And I have with me today Brian Rose and Keith Ulrich from Insight Schools. It's an organization, company that is located in Portland, Oregon. We presently operate a school in the state of Washington. And we would like very much to be in the state of Oregon. The passage of this bill will allow that to happen. And I'd like them, at your indulgence, Madam Chair, to talk about their school and why we think this is the benefit to the state of Oregon to have our program available to Oregon students.
Did you need any? Were you planning on using any technical support?
Madam Chair, we decided not. We just have some handouts.
Okay. We received the handout.
Right.
Thank you. Go ahead.
Thank you. First, I want to thank you for the opportunity to speak with you. My name is Brian Rose. I'm the Vice President of School Development for Insight Schools. I have with me Keith Ulrich, who is our founder and CEO. As Stephen mentioned, we are a Portland, Oregon-based company. We've been here in Portland, Oregon for about 24 months, operating schools in Washington State as well as in Wisconsin. I want to take just a few minutes, if I could, to explain our approach to schools and then spend a little bit of time talking about our support for Bill 2037, if I could. The information you have in front of you is what I'm going to go through. If you could follow with me on just a little bit about Insight Schools. We're a school management company. We work in conjunction with the authorizing agency in a particular state. In most states, a single authorization with a school district will allow us to operate a school statewide. The schools are public, online, full-time, diploma-granting high schools. Our focus is on high school. We think there's some unique issues associated with high school students, and so we focus our energy on educating high school students. The education approach that we take allows those students to perform their studies independently at their pace, at their own place, at their own time. And that allows us to attract a unique set of students. And I'll talk just a moment about the characteristics of those students. The schools are public schools, and so they're tuition-free to our students and to the families that we serve. And due to our business model, we're able to operate those at no cost to the authorizing agency. Essentially, we are funded by the open enrollment dollars that follow those students. The mission really is to use this alternative education approach to attract a unique characteristic of student and really to provide them an alternative education approach that will allow them to enter back into the public school system and really to meet their unique potential. That's our mission. Just a bit about the demographics of the students that we serve. It shouldn't come as any surprise that some of the students we serve were traditionally homeschooled students. These are students that are in high school that have, to some extent, hit the ceiling as to where their parents can instruct them. And they're looking for certified instructors to assist them, as well as looking for a larger array of courses to choose from. That said, only about 10% of our students are really homeschooled students. The remaining characteristics of those students are we have students that are on both sides of the academic scale. We have students that are looking to accelerate through their program a lot faster than a traditional school can allow them to do. We also have students that are struggling a bit and are looking for more time to master material associated with being in high school. We have students that have family care responsibilities that had to drop out of school due to taking care of their own family, or perhaps they became pregnant and had to care for their child. We have students that don't do mornings. Quite frankly, they just can't do mornings. And so for them, starting school at 6 p.m. and going till midnight is a natural progression for them. They just can't get that in a traditional school. We also have kids that are physically unable to attend school. We have kids that are challenged by the large class sizes. All of those situations are uncomfortable for them, and this is a great alternative for them. Finally, we have students that are focused on careers. We have kids that are focusing on athletics. We have kids that are artists, and their focus is on their career, but they still desire to have a high school diploma. So these are the demographics of the kids that we're serving. And that's our focus as a company. We're passionate about serving that demographic of child. Just a bit about how we approach it. As I mentioned, we partner with the authorizing agency, and so this school is governed by the school board of that school district. We work with that school district to develop the policies and procedures, and we're governed by those policies and procedures. All the kids, as well as the school, is measured performance-wise by all of the federal and state standards. All of our kids have to take the same state test as any other public school student would have to take. Our school in Washington State is an accredited high school. The graduation requirements are set by the authorizing agency, and we provide a diploma which is a full high school diploma. It's not an alternative education diploma. It's a full state-recognized diploma. Our curriculum consists of 130-plus courses, very diverse curriculum that attempts to address all the needs and the interests of the child that we're trying to serve. And our instruction model allows us to be very personalized. Our students have more one-on-one opportunity with their instructors than they would have through a traditional high school experience. And finally, we realize that students go to school at times for social activities. And so we try to develop community-based activities such as field trips, career and job counseling. Those types of activities we also provide as a core part of our school. So we've already spent a little bit of time talking about the particular statute. And the fact that 50% of the students would need to reside in the district where our school resides. Quite frankly, what we're here to do is support House Bill 2037. We believe what it does is open up equal access to a quality education alternative for all students across the state. And we think that's critical not only for the students, but for operators such as ourselves to be able to bring this type of an education opportunity to the kids in Oregon. Our Washington State School, we opened last year. It's in operation. It's in partnership with a school district in Forks, Washington. That school is serving the entire state. We have 650 kids that are enrolled in that school. Those kids come from all over the state. We have kids in the urban environment. We have kids in rural Washington as well. When we opened the virtual doors of that school, we were hoping for 250 interested kids. We had over 3,000 kids interested in this school. And the demographics are exactly as the ones I described. These kids come from a varying background. But in many cases, life just happened to these kids. And they needed to have an alternative to the traditional school that they were accustomed to in order to be able to complete their high school and get a diploma.
A little bit more about teacher survey.
If I could, just a bit about the teacher. All of the teachers are certified teachers in the state that we operate. Our current student-teacher ratio in the state of Washington is 19-1. And one of the unique factors that we bring is that each student is assigned a what we call mentor at the point where they enroll. They have an instructor for each course, and that instructor is focused on teaching the course. But this mentor has a 360-degree view of the student and is focused on making sure that that student is keeping up with their courses and is keeping up with an individual student learning plan that we develop, which is unique for each student. So those mentors are not only keeping track of where they are in their classes, but they're keeping track of how they're doing in the courses. Are they staying engaged? If they don't contact or log in after a certain period of time, those mentors are on the phone with the student and with the teachers or with the parents to see what's going on with that child. So that's a unique component of our instruction model, is what allows us to deliver the results we do.
Representative Dahlem.
Yes, thank you very much. You talked about unique students, and I'm going to ask you some questions that I think are. Do you have any students in your school system that are simply short of credit and come to the Phoenix School so that they might accomplish their credit in government or another credit in math?
Are you asking?
Do you have that kind of student?
Part-time
in Washington? Yes, part-time.
All of our students in Washington State are full-time students.
You accept only full-time students.
That's correct.
Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm. Representative Buckley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Since you've only been going to Washington for a short period of time, I don't know whether you have. Do you have comparable test scores as to how your students are performing compared to traditional high school students?
If I could, I'd ask my colleague Keith if you could respond to that question.
I'll have to ask you to announce your name over the microphone.
Sure, hi. I'm Keith Ulrich, the founder of Insight Schools. And the short answer is for Insight Schools, we don't have test scores yet. We're in our first school year.
Okay.
Several of us who founded this company have previously started online schools in other states, online public schools, as well as running the largest private online school in the country. And their test scores for our initial public school, which was in Wisconsin, students scored better than the state averages on the required state test there, which is a 10th grade test in the first year of experience there, which was just a couple of years ago. And then in the private school, students didn't have to take state tests because it was a private school, but our national student population generally scored 3 to 4 points better than national averages on tests like the SAT and the ACT. So it's very early. This is we're in the early stages of development of this industry, and so there's not a lot of public test score data at the high school level, although I'm sure we'll see some of the work from some of the other programs that are focusing on lower grades have been around for a few more years and have some test scores that I think are pretty good.
I'm interested, thank you, Madam Chair, for a follow. Mr. Ulrich, maybe you'd be the best person to answer this. I'm interested in how you address the kind of geography you're dealing with, and it was mentioned in the handout, when you try to organize group activities with a student body that's spread over such a huge expanse of the state, how exactly does that happen, that you actually engage kids in the social part of high school as well?
Take that. Yeah, we oftentimes we have what we call coordinators. That turns out those coordinators are oftentimes parents of kids that are attending the school. And so for the social activities side of our business, we will organize activities around those coordinators, and we will determine the geographic location of those kids and organize those activities around that. So we try to group kids that are geographically close to each other for those activities. Things like proctored exams, those are a little bit different, and we will proctor those exams, and we have somebody authorized to be there as a proctor to sit through those tests.
Thank you. Representative Cannon. It's after lunch. My brain is foggy.
Thank you, Chair Tom. I appreciate your testimony and your work as educators. My questions are on a slightly different tack, however. Is University of Phoenix a publicly traded company?
Madam Chair, Representative Cannon, yes, it is. Let me be clear. The parent company, Apollo Group, is a publicly traded company.
Okay. Follow up, please.
Yes.
Would you be able to share with us either now or in submission, written submission to the committee, reports, financial disclosures that relate to the profitability of this particular group, Insight, or the Apollo group? I'm interested really in finding out whether this is a profitable enterprise. If so, how profitable, et cetera.
Madam Chair, Representative Cannon, let me assure you the University of Phoenix has been highly profitable over the years. It's been a Wall Street darling. This is a separate company, and I'll have to ask them about the profitability of their schools.
Well, I don't actually know. It's, we're newly part of a publicly traded company, so I don't actually know what we can disclose publicly. I would say that in our initial establishment of schools, we will generally invest several hundred thousand dollars in creating a school to serve a given state. In the first year of a school, project that that school is sort of operates it at a small loss, which we expect to recoup over a 4 or 5 year period.
I don't know if my understanding is that as a publicly traded company, you're required to make certain financial disclosures. I know those are available typically from SEC. If you would, I'd appreciate very much seeing any disclosures, public disclosures. I'm not asking, of course, for privately held information, but any public disclosures that you've made, I would appreciate seeing.
Madam Chair, Representative Cannon, you and I will see each other shortly, and I'll get some of my financial people together. We'll work that out.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, could all of us get a copy of that?
Yes. Can we, Mr. Cooper, can we get that? Thank you.
Madam Chair, the only question I was answering, I think, was to get it narrowed down to exactly what the question is. Once I get the question,
got it. Okay.
Then I get the information. Get whatever information. That's why I wanted. I wasn't meaning to give him secret information.
He's not 007.
Right. I'm just trying to find out exactly what he wanted. Have a conversation
Perfect.
With Representative Cannon and our financial people. Once that answer comes, of course, I'll share it with them.
Thank you.
Yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Could we also, as part of the information, could we get contact information from someone in the Washington Department of Education in Wisconsin, Department of Education, who you've worked with, so we can get their point of view?
Madam Chair, Representative Buckley, we will have that information to the committee administrator by the end of the day.
Thank you.
That'd be great. Representative Roblin,
Thank you.
I just have two quick questions also.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Being originally from Port Angeles, Washington, and knowing Forks well, another very small rural school district, how many of the 650 kids are actual Forks residents? Do you know that information?
There's two, right? I think it's two.
Okay. Thank you.
Interesting. I have a couple of technical questions, and it doesn't matter who answers those. Are your certified teachers highly qualified under the No Child Left Behind Act?
Yes, they are.
Okay. I was wondering about a little bit more about your student demographics. Do you have special ed students?
Yes, we do.
Talented and gifted?
Yes, we do.
Second language learners?
Yes, we do.
Oh, poor, impoverished, that's the other category. I was trying to think, what else do we have?
To the best of our ability, of course, we don't serve lunch in a virtual school, but we did have some free and reduced lunch forms filled out, and the best that we can determine is we're exceeding 30% free and reduced lunch in the state of Washington.
And so, because No Child Left Behind Act is big in many of our lives, so have you gotten a report card, or are you... Your students are meeting adequate yearly progress, or are you not a part of that regulation?
No, we are still a part of that. I think it's still a bit too early for us to know for sure where we're at on that.
Okay.
Yeah, but we are absolutely held to the same requirements as any other public school.
Okay. Last one. Are your coordinators that you talked about, is that a paid position?
No, the community coordinator is
a
parental position that is not a paid position,
okay.
No.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you for your presentation.
Thank you very much.
Peter Stewart? Stewart? Interesting stuff.
Madam Chair, my name is Peter Stewart. I'm the Senior Vice President for School Development for K-12 Incorporated. I came today with one handout, and I had the chance during the summer to make a presentation to, I believe, four of the seven members in a situation much like this. It ran short, and we never got to Q&A, and I was going to do a demo. So I have the demo with me, if that would be helpful to the group, and seeing what it is that we're talking about when we talk about e-learning, but only if you think there's time, it would be appropriate.
How long does it take you to set that up?
Oh, set up now.
Oh, it's set up?
Sure.
Go for it.
Okay.
I want to see technology in action.
Okay.
Now, you're the teacher. Let's see how long it takes you to take attendance and get this thing started.
How's that?
Pretty good.
All right.
A minus?
Yeah, easily.
A member who just spoke, talked about the idea of, e-learning that appeals to many different families. It appeals to many different learning types. One of the things I think it's important about, for your committee in thinking about innovation, is this the type of innovation that the state of Oregon wants to embrace? You already are doing a fair amount of it. The question here is do you want to do more, I guess? A program like ours is a web-based program, but I think it's also many times folks will have the impression that this is a child sitting at a computer day in, day out, and they think it's a bad thing, and so do most of the providers. We certainly do. The partners who we work with tend to choose our program because what they're looking for is a more balanced approach. So, for instance, last year, I think in third, fifth, and seventh grade, they do an awful lot with life science. We shipped in 2 tons of dirt. So families are getting dirt in a high-tech program. And the reason for that is if you're planting seeds and you're looking at germination, you want to have the same results in Arizona, in Oregon, or in New Jersey. And so we get our dirt from one place. We ship in books. We ship in musical instruments, clay for art. It's a very complicated process. I was a principal in a school, and when you receive, your shipment for the summer, there's a lot of it. This is, infinitely more complicated because if you have 3,000 students, you have 3,000 different combinations of courses and materials and things that go in, and you also have to be able to get those materials back. Not all schools do things with physical materials. We do, but there are lots of different models that are out there. So what would you see in a typical program? This is, I believe, typical second or third grade science. What we try to do is present to, for the teacher's access, who's working either face-to-face with students or at a distance, and for the person who is working with the child, the mentor, we try to make sure that they have at their fingertips all the information that a great trained teacher would also have. And so in the resources section, we'll try to make sure, for instance, that all the state standards of what you'll be talking about are all lined up for the lesson, so it's clear why you're teaching this and how it is relevant, in this case, to Oregon standards. And there's much more that's in there. Nice thing about databases is you can have all this information as long as you know where it is, and you don't have to overwhelm people with a teacher guide that's thousands of pages in length. In a lesson, there will be parts where students are just going back over knowledge that they've already learned. We do an awful lot of work in inner city. In inner city Philadelphia, most students don't know what a weather vane is. They've never seen a weather vane. We know that you have to have a program that is culturally sensitive to what students do and don't know from prior knowledge or from the cultural experiences. And over the time, the last 7 years, I think we've built up some of that expertise. But I'll get to a part that, we have hands-on experiments where a student will be building their own anemometer. And what I want to do is we do history. But most important, what makes a web-based program, I think, sometimes work will be the way that you can use simulations, animations, to bring a difficult concept to life. In this case, we're looking at the Beaufort scale. Those of you who are sailors know all about the Beaufort scale, and it's a way of looking at wind speed. We think it's a good lesson for third graders. And what you end up doing in a lesson like this is, in the teacher guide, you're going to go through what would be Bloom's taxonomy. You're going to try and get the students to have a hypothesis. You're going to have them try and make an educated guess of what they think will happen, and then you respond to that guest. We try and tie science together with, like good teachers do, science with writing. So students are now writing in their science journal. So you have multimedia, you have a hands-on activity students are doing, and now you have what would really be the kind of Socratic style of teaching. So you ask a third grader, what do you think will happen at a Beaufort scale of 4, and they make their predictions, then you take a look at it. And what happens? Well, the smoke is moving, the flag, etc. And then you keep moving up the scale. this is the kind of lesson, when you talk about web-based e-learning, this can be done in a classroom. This can be done after school. This can be done on weekends. This can be done for, if it was a higher level, for credit recovery. This could be done for gifted students who need to move more quickly, for students who are way behind. This is a way of appealing to a student who learns not just from text and by doing, but perhaps by watching. It's also engaging to students. You can imagine, I know Representative Ken is a teacher, I know you've been a teacher, Representative Comp, and many of others, when you get to this kind of a lesson, you have third and fourth grade, particularly a lot of the boys jumping out of their seat, and they want to know what happens at a 10. You know, they don't want to go 1 through 4 or any of that. They want to go right to the end, and you move up the scale. So what happens at a 9? And it gets, you know, more drastic. What happens in a hurricane? And you can see this, and then to make sure that everybody's happy, you can finish back at calm, and the lesson can end, and we can all go back to, you know, the way that we are learning. The point of showing the lesson is just simply that in the last 7 or 8 years, when I first testified about this in Pennsylvania, I've had the privilege of working in about 15 different states to set up statewide programs in the last 7 years that serve...
Back up from the mic.
Oh, sorry.
There you go.
That serve approximately 250,000 semester courses per year. So that's about 100,000 or 150,000, 125,000 year-long courses. That would be the equivalent of about 25,000 full-time equivalencies for students. So it's a wide program running in 15 states. We work with ESDs, or the equivalent in other states. We work with school districts. We work with brick-and-mortar schools. We work with charter schools. We're working with state departments of education. And so different states have figured out how to do this in different ways. 7 years ago, this was a crazy idea. And when you talk about this 7 years ago to members of the committee, they couldn't understand the idea of how virtual learning would have a role in a K-8 world, even at kind of some of it at the high school level. I think that that has changed. I think that throughout the country right now, it was the head of the U.S. Distance Learning Association last year who said, you know, the question isn't now, you know, are you doing it? It's what are you doing to keep up if you aren't? And I think that it is a timely discussion, you know, for your group, you know, to contemplate. You already have programs in Oregon. How do you want to grow them? And how do you want to make sure that they are highly accountable? What I handed out to each of you is a report from one of our partner schools, the Ohio Virtual Academy. It enrolls 3,000 students, K-10. You asked about AYP in the very opening. If you take a look in the opening of the front page, we got a letter from the State Board of Education in Ohio, and the school moved from its proficient level to an advanced level. That didn't happen easily. These schools, I think one of the myths is that the students who come to these schools will be those who are kind of headed off to the college track right away, and that is just not the case. I believe that school has 11% special needs students. It has, on average, the schools that we work with have about 34% who qualify for Title I, and they come for all types of reasons. What is interesting about this one and why I chose this to hand it to you is that this school went beyond what was asked of AYP and participated with the Department of Education in a value-added study, because what you want to be able to figure out is, you know, what kind of progress did you make with your students in a year? Did you make a year's gain? Did you make a year-and-a-half gain? If you're getting students who are 2 years below grade level, when you move them to grade level, you would just say that that's average. Well, that's phenomenal and should be awarded. We were the only virtual school to volunteer and be selected to participate in this, and this is our partner. And most of the schools that we try to work with take that same level of accountability. There has to be a transparency to the taxpayer, to the Department of Education, to the school board, to the authorizer, because this is a new model. And not all schools take that approach. And I think that's one of the things to be considered for your group, is what do you want to do to make sure that however virtual schooling is expanded in the state, how are you going to make sure that it's accountable? Because that's a crucial issue. And for a movement like this to grow, it has to be able to show, you know, that they are good stewards of the tax dollar, as well as that there's a return on investment, that students are having more options, and that scores are increasing, and that ultimately, if it's through the charter group, or through the charter law, that it is doing what it set out to do, which is to provide innovative options for families and teachers across the state. So happy to take any questions.
Representative Buckley.
Thank you. This is a fascinating subject, so
I appreciate
your indulgence on this. Thank you very much for your presentation. So to kind of put you your organization in perspective. You mentioned you work with ESDs, with school districts, so you have a certain amount of flexibility to come in and say to a particular, say, let's take my Ashland School District, for instance, or in the Southern Oregon ESD, and say we've got a population of talented and gifted and also a population of folks who are struggling, and you could come in and say, I'm going to work with ESD to set up the ESD to run this type of program?
Sure. I mean, we're a curriculum company, first and foremost. Okay. So what you saw on the screen, that's what my company does, is we build curriculum. And we will help, and we also have a whole series of consulting services everywhere from, you know, just doing a little teacher training,
right,
that's all that was required, to an existing program, to helping a new program get launched, all the way up to helping to run a program. So in Washington, in Idaho, and in California, there are statewide programs that have asked us to come in and play a managerial role in how the school gets up and running. But always the teachers are always the employees of the not-for-profit, whether it's a school district or a charter. And so in this case, yes, we could come down and work with the ESD to do a program for gifted. We could do, I'm working in Philadelphia for a program, or a proposal at least, for pregnant teens. There's all kinds of things that we can do.
Quick follow?
Sure.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So do you have an opinion on this bill? Does this bill impact your possibility of working in our state in any way?
It does, in the sense that if... I'll give an example. If you were interested in offering this to as many families as you could right away, then the bill that is before you is a great way to do that. It's an ideal way to do that. The reason is that that program that you would start in Ashland, it will require a special ed director. It will require a business manager. It will require an infrastructure that is profound, whether it's 40 students or 400 or 4,000 students. The charter law would no longer be a vehicle for offering this, except in the very largest districts. So you could do it in a Portland, perhaps. That might be it. The reason being is that, you know, if this appeals to only 1% of a district's population, which is probably that's actually pretty high, then there isn't enough demand. And so what you wouldn't have is the district wanting to start their own program right away. The typical life cycle that I've seen has happened in other states is that if there is a charter law, there is often a lot of maybe Sturm und Drang that this will be taking away and be shutting down schools and closing programs, which tends not to ever happen. The next year, districts will see that there might be a number of students in their area who are interested by this charter option, and then they will come to us and say, we want to set up our own program. And they have, you know, the districts actually have an advantage over an Apollo or my group or any other, in the sense that they have all these fixed assets. They can offer a drama program right there where the students can be participating. They can do foreign language. They can do labs. They can do sports clubs. They can do all these things. They tend not to do that right away because they're struggling with AYP. They've got so many other things that this won't necessarily grab their attention. So if the committee wanted to make this option known to families far and wide across the state, perhaps, you know, far less than just 1%, that's still a lot of families that would be served.
Gotcha.
Yes, please do.
So, but if you were to come to, instead of the ESD, but come to the Ashland School District and say, well, here's a way, Ashland School District, you got a great speech and debate team, mm-hmm. you've got these great programs, we want our kids to have access to everything. We want them to have access to the best extracurricular activities and the best opportunities online. Is that the sort of program you can put together within a district using
absolutely.
The district's resources?
Absolutely. And so it could be just, you know, for part-time, just one course that's not offered by the Ashland School District. I mean, that's the thing about e-learning is it runs the gamut from, you know, the full-time student, the gifted student. So in Ashland, if they wanted to offer courses to students, you know, 50% of the time, 80% of the time, 100% of the time, 10% of the time, they can do that.
Great.
And the key is they have to have the infrastructure and the leadership that really wants it.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative
Roblin. Thank you, Madam Chair. The only handicap that Ashland would have is that most of our textbooks in Oregon go through a process where they are they are listed on the list, and if you aren't a school district of over 500,000, whatever,
we won't talk about that.
You have to pick from that list or do a waiver. And so, if they chose your curriculum, say they took liked your math at the 10th grade. You had a great geometry program.
Sure.
They loved it, and they just figured they wanted to use that and supplement what they were doing. They could buy it from you, but it would either be a supplement or they'd have to go through a waiver process to get it approved.
And we've had that in other states where you have to get, and certain states have a very rigid, and I don't think Oregon is one of them, really rigid textbook adoption where you just can't get one of those waivers. We have done that. And that's part of the reason I think that, you know, again, to go back to why a charter, that charters do have more control over their curriculum.
But you are more like a McGraw-Hill. I mean,
yeah.
Curriculum company.
That's right.
Yeah. I mean, that,
that's right. And, you know, and we've had to go into the service business because, you know, there isn't a group out there that naturally does this.
Right.
The only question I have is, is there a bias or discrimination if a potential if students don't have their own technology at home, or have you dealt with sites then
sure.
that provide the technology?
It depends on the funding in a state of what can be offered. In this state, you would be able to offer, with the funding level as I understand it from the charter law, that if a district wanted to sponsor a charter and they thought it would be a great idea and they wanted to serve statewide because the 50% rule was no longer there, you have the budget to provide to the family high-speed internet access, and you just basically pay that on a monthly basis, as well as a computer. One of the things that we do for districts, one of the things that, you know, you wouldn't think is all that complicated, but, you know, doing IT for 3,000 different installations
yeah.
is incredibly complicated. So you want them all to have the same computer. You want them to have, you know, when things go wrong, as they do, you want to be able to send in, you know, be able to try and fix it remotely, and if not, send in one of these, you know, gold disks that basically erases everything.
Mm-hmm.
And all of their test scores and everything are web-based, so that doesn't matter,
right.
and they can just reboot and do it that way. So in this case, you know, one way of looking at it is that public schools invest in the internal combustion engine. You know, you have to get students from home to the school, and that's a piece of technology. You know, we basically using, like, the same logic, kind of transportation dollars, you know, use the internet and a computer to connect the student to his or her teachers, his or her school, curriculum, instruction, all the rest.
Following the technology aspect of that, so how often do you do, I mean, do you upgrade the program every year, every 6 months? Your program design?
Just to give you an example, when Pluto was demoted from a planet to a dwarf
right.
planet,
right.
we fixed it in 24 hours. And so all of our lessons then reflected that online. Now, the print materials we won't be able to change until we do another reprinting.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, we update all the time. You know, you have to make sure that you're staying coordinated with the print stuff and what's out there. But, yes, we do that all the time. We're constantly upgrading our courses. And we're a young company. We're 7 years old. So we're building new courses constantly. We've built, 3,000 courses, and we add, you know, many more each year. And based on feedback, we can change things more quickly than a traditional publisher can.
Okay. And to clarify your K-12 curriculum process, too, like the previous presenter, they have curriculum for everything from kindergarten to 12th grade?
That's our name, and that's our aspiration. We have 10th grade completed now.
What I'm asking.
Yeah, we have 11. And what we do now is that's our own curriculum, and then what we do is we partner with existing curriculum providers for 11th and 12th grade. And over time, we'll probably do that less and less and use more and more of our own.
Okay. Representative Cannon.
Yes, thanks. As a teacher, I certainly appreciate, in fact, I love having curriculum options like yours out there. I think most people in this room would probably agree that curriculum is very often only as good as the hands of the person who's imparting it, helping the student navigate through it. How do teachers, in your experience, use this curriculum? What is the role of the teacher within your curriculum? I'm looking at the Ohio Virtual Academy and seeing that only 18.2% of their expenses are on salaries versus 72.7% on purchased services, which include your curriculum. And that's sort of the reverse balance to what
right.
we see in traditional public schools, where the teacher is really
sure.
you know, elevated and the curriculum is less. So how do teachers interface with your curriculum?
They to go to that, you know, one of the things when you're a school teacher and you're investing in science equipment, you don't have to buy a microscope for every student.
Mm-hmm.
In a virtual school, you do. You know, because we're a distance learning program, an e-learning program, you do. And so there are higher costs there. The teachers interface with the students in a number of ways. They are available during regular school hours, you know, and they run. We use a tool called Illuminate, which is so you have an eighth grader who's struggling, and you teach history, right? So you have an eighth grader who's struggling with, you know, something about ancient Mesopotamia, or it's a math problem, maybe it'd be a better example, and you go to the whiteboard. And you work with that student at the whiteboard. You have a marker, and you work on, you know, here's how you factor, and you show it. Our teachers can do exactly the same thing through a tool called Illuminate. And so they will work with either individual students or small groups of students who are struggling with the same topic synchronously. It's live. They have voice going at the same time. They have access to the whiteboard. What happens is what I do on my computer ends up on yours, and so we do instruction that way. We do instruction through a lot of training and coaching and making sure that you have good practices in place. So the teacher training runs everything from, you know, face-to-face to CD-ROMs to Illuminate sessions to you know, we'll bring groups of folks together who are struggling and do real small group instruction, as long as, and to some extent, geography is a player on that. In the more densely populated areas, we can do more of that than we do in the rural areas. But the teacher is a constant role in the student's life. They're also able to monitor on a real-time basis, live, what's been completed. There's constant flow back and forth of completed materials, of submitted materials. The teachers do you know, the grading of essays and all the rest of it. So there's a constant dialogue back, which you don't spend a lot of time doing, and which is why we don't have a hard time recruiting really talented, wonderful teachers, is you don't spend a lot of time on classroom management. Which is, you know, a lot of, you know, when you're an elementary school teacher, a high school teacher, unfortunately, we spend a lot of time on, you know, administrivia and classroom management, and not on just kind of pure. Well, you know, I was a principal, and we hand it out all the time. You know, that's what we do sometimes. So, I think that's the difference in the experience. But the teachers will tell you that they know their students, their virtual students, as well or better than they knew their students in their classroom, especially at the high school level, where when the bell rings, you know, 35, 40 students get up and leave, another 35 come in, and you're trying to teach the many. Oftentimes, you're teaching the same thing to kids who have different needs. Our program allows a lot more, and any of the programs allow a lot more customization to a learner's needs.
Thank you.
Did that answer your question?
Yeah, good. Thanks.
Oh, because I was thinking your perspective was you're teaching in a traditional classroom. How could we possibly access or support each other?
Oh, we do that as well. I mean, we're a curriculum company. So, I mean, if you wanted that science program in your classroom, we built it so you wouldn't need to have the overhead projector, and we like to use a smart board, so it's an interactive whiteboard. But when you have those things, you have a really powerful teaching tool. And there's only, you know, two ways to improve student achievement. It's either to spend an awful lot of time improving the quality of instruction, which is what, you know, we all try and do with the limited dollars and time that districts have. You're spending a lot of time trying to train your teachers to be more effective in their daily instruction and or give them better tools. And we try and do both, whether it's in a virtual setting or in a traditional classroom.
Well, I thank you for your time, because I could have a personal conversation about accelerated programs for after school and, you know, help all students know how to read by third grade, but we won't take the committee's time with all those details. So.
Anytime.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Okay, next we have Steve Buckstein, and you're from the Cascade Policy Institute. And then after that, we will have a couple. We have several more presenters in the one you're asking about as well.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair.
Good afternoon, Chair Comp and members of the committee. Is this loud enough? It's hard to tell.
Plenty. Yeah, we sit back this far, and okay. We have no problem at all.
My name is Steve Buckstein. I'm Senior Policy Analyst and founder of Cascade Policy Institute. We're a public policy research organization based in Portland. And as we're talking about today, and as you know, one section of public charter school law, ORS 338, requires 50% of online charter school students to live within the district that charters that school. And I'm wondering, why should the state of Oregon impose such an artificial, what I consider an artificial barrier, on the power of the Internet to help kids learn? History teaches us, and I hope history classes in our regular public schools teach this, how the fear of change almost stops progress from time to time. And if you remember the Luddites in the early 19th century in England, they were textile workers who smashed the new steam-powered looms in a misguided attempt to protect their jobs. They lost their battle when it became clear that the Industrial Revolution was making life better for most people. Today's Luddites oppose the Internet Revolution. For various reasons. Some fear for their teaching jobs if too many students find ways to learn online rather than sitting in traditional classrooms. But I think the legislative intent behind the charter law, 338, is pretty clear. Part of it says, quote, it's for the creation of a legitimate avenue to take responsible risks to create new, innovative, and more flexible ways of educating children within the public school system, unquote. Some of the goals of the legislation include increasing student learning and achievement, which we all want to see, increasing choices of learning opportunities for students, and encouraging the use of different innovative learning methods. So I would ask the committee to think about how those progressive goals apply to the Internet, to online learning. I think the very nature of the Internet liberates us from geographic restrictions and barriers. It allows us to talk with and to learn from people all over the world just as conveniently, just as inexpensively as we learn from our classroom, from our historic classroom teachers. So requiring half the kids in an online charter school to live within one district's boundaries is a little like telling eBay users or eBay buyers in the state that they have to purchase half their, they have to make half their purchases in their local hometown. That may be an effective jobs protection program for the local merchants, but it hurts every consumer in the state. Or, I think another example, it's a little like saying that 50% of the people watching this hearing right now on the OregonChannel.com through the power of the Internet must live in Salem. Why do you encourage all Oregonians to watch and learn from your proceedings right here today while at the same time you put an artificial barrier on students in online schools, and so you basically build a wall around that charter school and you keep most of the kids in the state out of that school? I'm able to take advantage of that experience. I think the Luddites of, again, early 1800s in England would love such restrictions if they were here today. But most Oregonians are more enlightened than that. We know that allowing new and innovative and more flexible ways to educate our kids are essential in this information age. So I think what we should be doing is removing the artificial barriers, if we can, that stand in the way of Internet learning. So to paraphrase a quote from history and to tone it down just a little bit, Madam Chair, tear down this wall. Thank you for allowing me to speak, and I'd be glad to try to answer any questions.
Thank you. Any questions from the committee? Representative Roblet?
Thank you, Madam Chair. In your capacity as a researcher, have you found online schools that are totally private, online schools out there, being successful?
Chair Comp, Representative Roblin, I have not done that particular research. I'm not arguing for totally private, totally public. I think it's the competition and the choices that are important here, not the ownership model of the school or of anything on the Internet, for that matter.
So,
go ahead, follow up.
Follow up, and then you would not even have a restriction on they should be Oregon students.
No, I wouldn't. I'm not arguing that you should go that far, but I think that's something to consider.
You just took a big leap.
Well, no, I mean, from my perspective, it wasn't a big leap. Other than the fact that Oregonians would be paying for other students who were not necessarily Oregon students. That is the big leap. But if you extend the original...
That's a good point, because if the funding for Oregon public, and they are public charter schools, comes from the revenue that the legislature allocates to the district, you would have an out, in effect, because you're not allocating any funds for out-of-state students. That would have to change, too, which I assume it's not going to do.
Now you're making me edgy. Representative Buckley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Betson, can I just respectfully and gently comment back on your analogies here? The difference between eBay buyers and even folks who are watching the Oregon Channel right now is the difference between adults and kids. And we are responsible for the education of our kids. Do you have any concerns at all about the ability for a school district who is responsible for the children living in their vicinity to make sure that those kids are not falling through the cracks, given virtual learning, given the distance where a child might live, and any sort of accountability or any sort of physical supervision of that child's learning? Do you have any concerns at all?
Chair Comp, Representative Buckley, that's a good question. And nothing, if all you do is pass this bill and eliminate that 50% restriction, nothing says that a district has to charter an online school at all, let alone one that is dealing outside the district. I assume districts would be able to say, we may charter an online school, but only if it serves our district. I think those are separate questions. Of course, I have concerns about, you know, what's going on with the children's learning. But the 50% rule puts an artificial barrier in front of it's not so much the children, but it's the families. I mean, the families are I don't assume a third grader is making a choice of, you know, a particular online school, but those families are being limited to their opportunities, especially when you have, well, any district in the state. Why shouldn't they be able to choose a school chartered in SIO or Portland or anywhere else if that district feels that it can manage that charter?
Absolutely. As I understand the bill, and correct me if I'm wrong, there's nothing currently right now that would keep a district from having a charter school that has its own online focus. What we're talking about is a educational organization that's located geographically distant from that child's home. We're trying to find out what's the balance here in terms of making sure we provide access to all students so they can have the benefit of the creative programs, but then where is the accountability for it? If I'll go take back to Jackson County, if I have students in Jackson County who are taking online courses from a provider in Portland, how does my district follow up? There is a rule of accountability to make sure that these kids in Jackson County are getting the education that they need. And I think that's the concern about the physical presence of an organization.
Chair Comp, Representative Buckley, I think you already have means of doing that. For example, with homeschoolers, the state supposedly is responsible. There are tests that are required, and as I understand it, those students are on average scoring significantly better than kids in traditional schools. Private schools, it's the family. The family's putting up their own private dollars, and the school has to be accountable to the family. I think that's still the case, even if it's a public school, except in traditional public schools, the families really don't, as I see it, have as much role as they should, because they can't take their dollars and go somewhere else. They're basically captives of where they can afford, in many cases, especially lower-income families, where they can afford to live. The online charter school is one method to give those families some, I mean, quite a lot of alternatives that they don't have now. So again, I see the accountability issue as separate from the 50% rule. And if it is, I mean, taking another leap, school districts are an artificial construct too, and we have them. Charter schools right now have to go to their local district, you know, and our organization has done a lot of work on, you know, looking at quote-unquote ideal charter laws, and we wouldn't have that restriction if we could, you know, have our way. But it's there. So I think this, to me, the 50% rule is just one of the simplest artificial barriers that you can do away with and still have all the other accountability in the law.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for your testimony. We have Lori Wimmer Whalen.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and committee members. For your record, Lori Wimmer Whalen from the Oregon Education Association, representing 46,000 community college and K-12 employees, educators, and classified alike. First of all, I was intimately involved in the passage of Senate Bill 1079 from the 2005 session, and I also serve on the Department of Education's Oregon Virtual Schools Advisory Council and helped to develop the regulations for the virtual charter school in Oregon and the portal that is offered to students. And I'd like to correct the record on some of the characterizations that are made about access. It is the role of the virtual school district portal to offer high-quality programs from vendors from all over the place. And if they choose to be a part of that portal, they can be, as long as they are high-quality programs that meet the law's needs. And so let's remember that 50% requirement that we're talking about today isn't a part of the original 1999 charter school law. It's a part of the 2005 virtual school law, which just passed by your colleagues in the last session. So, and that was part of a carefully crafted set of balances so that we could produce something that would enable students in Oregon to have access to high-quality virtual education with some quality control as a consumer protection mechanism. And that's what the virtual school
district does. It's not technically a real district the way we think about school districts. What it is an electronic portal that's developed to produce that delivery of educational services, and any of these vendors could be a part of it if they desired to be part of that program. And in fact, we have a number of online programs also provided by school districts. Salem-Keizer, for example, has SK Online. It's a wonderful program. The Lynn Benton ESD, I think, produces something called Cool School, and that's another one. And they were also at the table as a part of the Virtual School Advisory Committee that developed the regs and the offerings and so on. And that is still underway and in development, I guess you'd say. But we're pretty excited about that because it is a wonderful learning tool. And it's not a matter of virtual schools, yes or no. It's how and by whom and at what level, and is it appropriate for every student? My son's taken online classes, and what I've learned about him is that he's not self-motivated or disciplined enough to be a good candidate for online education because it's too self-directed, and that's not the best structure for him. The testimony I've handed out to you identifies what some of our concerns are about this bill, though. And the requirement that 50% of students in an online virtual school be based inside the sponsoring district was a threshold that was not established lightly. So therefore, of course, you won't be shocked to hear that I'm asking that you retain this new law. We believe that there are valid research-based and experience-based reasons for proceeding carefully into the brave new world of computer hell as teacher. And I've given you some of the other side of the story. Not all of the providers are reputable. Not all of the experiences have been successful. And not all of the students have been well served out there. One of the pieces of it, excuse me, I need a little water, but one of the pieces of information I've attached to my testimony is the report by the Legislative Audit Committee in Colorado, a state roughly the same size as Oregon, but with 18 online providers and 6,200 students currently taking courses. Thank you very much. Their legislature ordered this performance audit in November 06. Actually, they started in January or February of 06 and finished it in November 06. So this is very recent information. And I've not given you the entire 85-page report, but I have given you a summary. And I think if you look through, you will see that there is another side to this this industry, particularly some of the for-profit enterprises as opposed to some of the school district or non-profit enterprises. Not all of them are as reputable and fabulous as K-12. The 50% threshold, however, enables the state of Oregon to ensure that private vendors don't exploit the combination of Oregon's charter school, homeschool, and virtual school laws, which taken together, in effect, operate as a backdoor open enrollment policy, which we don't have for other kinds of public education. And for those of us who do school finance a lot in this building, that's kind of the chaos theory. You never know where your students are going to be at any given moment in time. That makes it very tough to manage financially a school district. And also looking at the Colorado experience, I think what you'll see is that in the period of 2003 to 2006, without the kind of good controls that Oregon has established in their Department of Education, and without the kind of oversight and parameters, not only did their program grow exponentially, they doubled their students in that three-year period and quadrupled their costs, but they also ended up with a lot of problems, and I've outlined in bullet point form some of those problems, such as performing poorly on their state exams. The students there were 4 to 6 times more likely to repeat a grade than students statewide in public schools. The attrition rate for students in online programs were almost 3 to 4 times higher than the attrition for students statewide. The aggregate dropout rate was between 3 and 6 times higher than the statewide rate. And one of the things that I looked for was to see whether they had a disproportionate share of at-risk kids that would explain those really high numbers. And the fact is that they did not, at least not according to the legislative audit. They also had all kinds of other things that happened that were constitutional violations, health and safety violations, student records retention violations. 100% of the samples of the records they looked at were incomplete and didn't even demonstrate that the students were enrolled. So there are problems when these programs go out when they're allowed to go out there and flourish without any kind of independent controls, which is why the Department of Education asked the last legislative session to take a look at a way to make sure that virtual learning in Oregon was of the highest quality and that that could be guaranteed. We have a requirement that all of the teachers be certified. We have a requirement for the in-district versus out-of-district so that entrepreneurialism isn't guiding the flourishing of these programs so much as quality and demand, which I think we can all agree is ideal. Last week also, Dr. Richard Sims came to Oregon and testified to the Joint Revenue Committees about the best investment the state can make in order to stimulate its economy so that we don't go through the kinds of hard times we did a few years ago with our recession. And he said that education is not only a good human investment, it's the best economic investment we can make. And the reason for that is that those dollars circulate inside the state's borders, at least with brick-and-mortar programs. And one of the dangers of an over-reliance on education providers who would be based outside the state is that we no longer benefit from that economic stimulus if those dollars are going to businesses headquartered outside of Oregon. So it's another point. It may seem minor to you, but we have, as I said, many in-state programs already that are up and running, whether it be through Portland State University's online program or at some of the other school district programs I mentioned, and even private providers, all of which are going through the portal. As I said, I have served on the Virtual School District's Advisory Council for the last 2 years, and one of the interesting things that we heard about was from an education psychologist by the name of Dr. Doreen Dodgen McGee, who presented to the Virtual School Advisory Council, and it was online so that anyone could access her presentation. One of the things that is a current kind of pioneering area of scientific study in brain research is how relational learning is important, actually critical to especially elementary age students. And without that face-to-face contact, there are certain kinds of learning that cannot take place. And it's also true that the response effect of sitting in front of a screen or technology, whether it's television or video games or online learning, that there's an upward limit, the research shows, to what how much of that would be healthy for a child. And they found that certain neuron pathways are encouraged with that kind of contact, and others atrophy. And one of the areas of atrophy are creative problem solving. And this is, as I said, really nascent research. A lot needs to be done before we have any conclusions about how much is enough or too much or the right amount. But it was interesting to hear that in this brave new world of virtual learning, that there may be some concerns, not just around curriculum quality, but around the very use of that tool in terms of how it wires the brain. So I think that the virtual school district program is going to have a very thoughtful and holistic approach for making sure that Oregon students get the very best quality virtual education. And so, in terms of the balance that we believe is called for in terms of proliferation, profit, and performance of these brave new educational tools, we respectfully ask this committee to leave the law as it was passed just a year and a half ago. Thank you.
Representative Minnis.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Lori, how long has this virtual schools program been in Oregon? How long have students been able to access the portal or a virtual school program?
Chair Conference, Representative Minnis, as I said, it was passed at the very end of the 2005 session, so it has been under development in the interim, and I think it's up and running. I wouldn't swear to that now, but maybe somebody from the department could answer that. However, there have been online programs in Oregon in operation far longer than that. My research last night when I was looking over some old records showed that it may very well be the very first virtual school offering in the United States was the Eugene School District's online program, which no longer exists, but I think it was the first according to this research.
Could you, Lori, tell me what kind of abuse took place that prompted the bill last session? Is there an abuse? Was there a problem that's developed? What prompted the bill last session?
Chair Compton, Representative Minnis, as I said, I've attached several articles to my testimony that identify some of the concerns that educators have had about some of the providers of services who have been unable to help students achieve the kinds of state benchmarks that would be expected.
Is that in other states or is that in Oregon?
That was primarily in other states because at the time it was a very new thing in Oregon, and I think it was preventative in nature, not in response to any particular issues in Oregon.
Okay, can I just be very candid with you and ask you a question? Because there's been an assertion as it relates to this bill that this is more about a union effort to make sure that the union had an opportunity to make sure the teachers stayed in the classroom than it was. And I'm just going to lay it out there because it's a pretty big elephant in the room, and I'd like you to respond. I'd give you an opportunity to respond. Is that, in fact, the motive behind the bill that was passed last session, or...
No, Chair Compton, Representative Minnis, it was actually not our bill. The Department of Education came to Senator Richard Devlin, who was the chief sponsor of the bill, and he asked for our support. I didn't even know of it until after it was printed in the bill set.
Thank you. That clears that up.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Cannon.
Thank you, Chair Compton. But Lori, in Oregon's current charter school law, as I understand it, the only entity that's able to charter a school is a school district, and that is a sort of accountability measure, accountability to the public, that their elected officials, their school board members are ensuring the public interest by chartering and perhaps rechartering or revoking the charter of a school district. So I'm a bit puzzled about why a school district like SIO would charter a school that serves only several kids in their district, and I wonder, are there incentives that skew SIO's decision-making and so that it's not in the public, perhaps skew it away from the public interest and towards something else?
Chair Compton, Representative Cannon, thank you. I did address this in my written testimony, but not in my verbal remarks. The way it works for Oregon is that a school district retains a piece of the ADMW for every student. It's 80% at the elementary level, I believe, and 95% at the high school level that goes to the provider of the services, and the balance is withheld by the district for covering off their administrative costs. Sometimes they end up providing special education services for students who need them, or ELL and that sort of thing. In the case of SIO, it is my understanding, and perhaps they do a better job of speaking to themselves what their motives are, but there would have been a financial incentive for a very struggling small school district that didn't feel that it had enough resources to run the program in the brick-and-mortar school to be entrepreneurial, frankly, to be able to offer a program virtually that scooped up the kids from all over the state who were at that time being homeschooled and offer this as a product to actually make money on those kids who weren't even inside their school district. And one other thing about the Colorado audit, they found their formula is similar to ours, where there's a hydraulic between the state share and the local share, is that had the students in Colorado who were signed up in similar kind of program for the similar kind of reason actually gone through a portal such as the Oregon Virtual School District and stayed in the residential district where they reside, I think in Colorado they found $6.8 million a year would have been saved. So it actually cost the state more money to do this program. And as I said, it's mostly about scooping up kids from other residential school districts and offering them these distance learning opportunities.
Go ahead, Representative.
Thank you. I appreciate your testimony and I appreciate the research you did because when I was in Coos Bay in the school system, we began a online charter school. It was one of the ones listed. It has 55 students currently, five of which were outside the district. The others are in. And in our research, it became clear that if you wanted to retain students, if you wanted them to be successful, you had to have contact with them. An adult needed to sit down and talk to that student some of the time. It couldn't all be online. Similar to what you were saying with your son. And so the decision was made on our district board, different than SIO's. And Coquille had tried earlier than SIO, and that caused a real problem for Coquille because they were denied at the time. And but in our research, having them have a commitment that they're going to come to the brick-and-mortar place and meet with an online staff one day a week to go over what they've done, to check that they've done, and also to provide computers there so they could work there if they would rather, has provided a much clearer way for us to identify the problems that are happening, how to correct them when they're going on, and how to make those adjustments that need to take place in the curriculum and other things that it's difficult to do online. I think we're getting better at some of that online stuff, but some of the research you show here indicates the same thing that we had found, that as a district it was difficult for us, and as a group that was organizing, it would be difficult for us to feel that responsibility and recognize that we could hold it for a period of time. There was issues with regard, when we were looking at it, with regard to who was actually doing the work at the other end, and was it the person who was signed up? And there was no way for us to know that. When the student has to come in and have a conversation about what they did, it's pretty clear to know who was that was working on the machine and the stuff at the time. So those were issues about accountability that our district felt very strongly about, and I think it's one of those that makes me concerned. So I appreciate some of this information, too. Thanks.
I just have one quick question. Do you know if any of the presenters we've had today were any of the service providers in Colorado, or is there a way we can find out who the service providers were in Colorado?
Chair Comp, I think that I'll get you the link so that you have the URL for the complete study. They probably have it in the full report.
Okay.
I don't know off the top of my head. Okay. I suspect not.
I suspect not, too, but I'd want to make sure. So, thank you. We have three. Thank you very much. We have three more presenters, and we have about 20 minutes left to this committee meeting, so not that I want to rush anybody along, but to Rob Kramer, you're signed up to present, and then we have two other folks.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Rob Kramer. I am with the Oregon Education Coalition, and I'm here to speak on behalf of the Oregon Connections Academy. My offices are in Portland, Oregon. Been associated with Connections Academy since they tried to start its first charter school in the Scioto School District. I'm not going to speak today. I'll be very brief. I won't speak today about the virtues of online education, e-learning, because I think others have done that far more eloquently than I can. I would like to talk a little bit about this bill, though, and what this bill does. And I'd like to point out to the committee that we've actually been informed of what I think is an astounding admission of public policy by the Oregon Department of Education here today, something that maybe it doesn't quite strike you as overtly as it did me when I heard it, and that is that the Oregon Department of Education in 2005 requested that a bill be passed that would result in, knowingly by the Oregon Department of Education, closing down a school of as many as 2,000 students and just shutting the doors on it. And that was apparently, if we are to believe the testimony of the officials of the Oregon Department of Education, that was with knowledge of foresight that they were asking to make that a part of public policy, that they should start a school, allow a school to start, allow it to grow, bring in a private company that would invest millions of dollars in Oregon, marketing the school, sending computers and equipment and curriculum to homes, and then 5 years later, shut it down. That is what the Department of Education has testified to us today. Now, I would suggest that the question of grandfathering of this 50% provision by Oregon Connections Academy is not at all a trivial question. It is a very crucial question. It's a crucial question for the Connections Academy. I was there at the start of this school, and I was there over the last several years as it's grown. I would suggest that it is not indeed the case that the grandfather clause only survives the first contract. In fact, I would suggest that it makes no sense at all as a matter of public policy for that have to have been the knowledge of the Oregon or the opinion of the Oregon Department of Education on the front end. I personally had this conversation with Randy Harnish this last August in his office. I asked him directly whether the renewal of the ORCA's contract would result in the grandfather clause having gone away. He said he did not know and that they intended to ask the Attorney General's office that question. Now, if he now says that at the time in 2005 it was their understanding at the Department of Education that this grandfather clause would disappear on expiration of the contract. That then means that they knowingly had Connections Academy make this large investment, and the 2,000 families sign up for the school knowing that they would close the doors, and they neglected to tell Connections Academy about it. I find that rather astounding, and I hope that you do too. I'd like to read a letter from Jeff Krupp, who you all know, former member of this body. And I have this in only one hard copy, and I will send this to the committee administrator tomorrow when I can print it off. Dear Chair Comp and members of the House Education Innovation Subcommittee, I was a member of the Oregon House of Representatives from 1999 until 2007, and last session I sat on the House Budget Committee when Senate Bill 1071, which established the 50% residency requirement that is being discussed in this hearing, was approved. In addition, I am chairman of the board for Oregon Connections Academy, which operates Oregon's only virtual charter school. As I said, for the record, when Senate Bill 1071 was moved out of the Budget Committee in August 2005, it was my understanding from conversations with the Oregon Department of Education officials that 1071 did not apply to ORCA and that ORCA would be grandfathered from the 50% requirement contained in 1071. I was never led to believe that this grandfather status would survive only until ORCA's initial charter contract was renewed. If I thought that this was the case, I would never have voted in favor of moving the bill out of the Budget Committee, much less voted for it on the House floor. I believe my colleagues had the same understanding. I am very concerned, judging from the Oregon Department of Education spokesperson's statement in the newspaper yesterday, that the ODE is now of the opinion that ORCA must comply with the 50% residency requirement when its initial contract expires. This would certainly result in the shutting the doors on a school that serves nearly 2,000 Oregon students. I cannot imagine that this legislature would consider this to be good public policy. Sincerely, Jeff Krupp. With that, I would be happy to answer your questions.
Representative Buckley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Kramer, in reading the statute, I think we have a problem here, because when I read the statute, there's nothing in there about a grandfather clause. So I think there's going to have to be discussions with Department of Education and your organization in terms of what if legislation additional legislation is going to be required. But again, there is nothing in the statute at present.
Madam Chair, Representative Buckley, that is true. There is not. And that's why at the time it was being pushed in the late of 2005 Thank session you. That several legislators asked that specific question and were assured by Oregon Department of Education officials that they were indeed grandfathered. And now 2 years later, we are told that at the time the Oregon Department of Education neglected to tell them that that grandfather status only was for the first term of the contract, and they allowed then a school to be created, sign up thousands of families, only to knowingly be shutting the doors on those families 5 years later. And if that's good public policy, I would like to see somebody argue how it is.
Screen, just to follow and to understand a little bit more about operations, and this might also apply to some of the other presenters here today, the ability for SIL and Oregon Connections to contract with districts in the state, is that, again, given the, I guess, concern that an organization such as the Oregon Connections might be able to kind of cherry-pick students from different districts, is there an ability to make a deal with districts around the state, so to address the needs or the concerns of districts around the state? I don't want you to negotiate in public. You don't have to. But I'm trying to figure out exactly how the organization works. Is there a certain number of students that is a minimum, or is there also a possibility for a maximum to be designated as well, trying to get the concerns of all addressed?
Madam Chair, Representative Buckley, I think that could be asked of Jim Thomas, who's the principal of Connections Academy, and I think he's testifying after I am.
Okay.
And that'd probably be more appropriately addressed.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Rob. Appreciate it. Jim Thomas and Matt Wingard, if you want to come up together. I think you're okay with sharing the table together. Okay.
Well, first of all, I'd like to thank Rob for throwing a hardball my way. I'm Jim Thomas. I'm the principal of Oregon Connections Academy. And my background is I was the superintendent of Sile School District for 8 years. Prior to going to take on the charter school here in, there in SIO. And with regard to the question, right now, frankly, there is no cap in terms of the numbers of students that we can enroll in ORCA. Our projection is to have approximately 3,700 students by the end of our first 5 years. I believe that's the number that comes to mind. You know, there is a question in terms of who we are and what we are. Well, first of all, we are a K-10 program, much like I didn't realize K-12 was only K-10, but we're very similar in some of the ways we do things in terms of the technology. But in terms of the accountability, I think that's an issue that we all are aware of. And I would like to invite the committee to come down the aisle to take a look at our program, seriously, because it's very hard to explain how our learning management system works in terms of the accountability we have to our students. I mean, in our program, there's no place to hide. It doesn't matter whether it's a student, the teacher, or myself, because we have reports that are done, it's data intensive, and we have to follow all the rules and regulations of the state of Oregon with regard to teaching to the standards. If a student is 10 days absent, he's dropped from our rolls. So we keep very close track of the attendance. We've even had students, in fact, just last week we had a student who was found to be plagiarizing. So we confronted the student about that, and we dealt with it. So we do have accountability built into our system. It's impressive. I mean, as a school superintendent for well over a decade, I take a look at this program, what it has to offer, and I'm excited about it. In fact, that's one of the reasons that when we were approached in SIO a couple of years ago, and they thought, is it something that SIO school just be interested in looking at? I said, yes, we would, because I like to think we're kind of the cutting edge of the technology. I mean, we're advocating the use of technology by our students in the classroom, and yet here we have a program that's dependent heavily upon the use of modern technology, whether it's whiteboard technology, the webmail, whether it's doing your lessons and taking assessments online, in addition to the portfolios, which are sent in monthly as opposed to some doing it two or three times a year. We pay postage to and from. We have all certified teachers who correct the paperwork that's sent in by grade level. So our program is, constantly evolving in terms of updating curriculum to meet the needs of the students. And when changes are made in terms of what the state requires, we make the changes accordingly. So from that perspective, it's important. I apologize for not having notes today, but when I read the paper this morning, I said, I can't just sit back and be quiet. Not that anybody would accuse me of sitting back and being quiet anyway. But, we are really concerned about the impact of what happens to our program in another 3 years when our contract with the SIO School District, or the ORCA Board, actually, ends. Because if we end up with our projections, the impact on the quality of education that we are providing to students throughout the state is going to be greatly impacted. And there's a few, not that I want to get into the, sob stories, but I mean, there's some students in our program who could not survive in a regular brick-and-mortar school for one reason or another. I got a call last year from a principal over in Eastern Oregon who had a fourth-grade student who needed a heart-lung transplant. I mean, that was really a heartbreaker, but the student got into our program, was able to maintain their academics, and did, in fact, have a heart-lung transplant, is now back in his regular school program. We have students involved in athletics at the professional level who are able to be in our program and to still compete and maintain their academic progress. We have students in special education. In fact, we were at the state board sitting back listening to the state board talk about a special ed request waiver we had. And the chairman of the board, Jerry Berger, asked, well, how do you serve special ed students? Because that's always a big one. How do you take care of these special ed kids? Well, and for many of these kids, it works out real well. You take a kid who has autism, or a student who's ADHD or ADD, like these acronyms, attention deficit disorder, hyperactive attention disorder. But these students have a hard time functioning in a brick-and-mortar school. And frankly, we have some kids who just socially don't work out real well in a brick-and-mortar school. And of course, that's the reverse of that is, the question is, what about those, how do they get the socialization? Well, we have 12 community coordinators throughout the state who provide activities every month for the students to participate as a group. And that's in addition to doing things that kids do like Boy Scouts, T-ball, soccer, and all these other social activities that most of our students are involved in. So we do take our education and our program very, very seriously. because we want our students to be successful. Last year, we made adequate yearly progress in every academic content area, including special ed. And I guess you might say in some ways the proof is in the pudding. You know, we are held to the same accountability standards as every other brick-and-mortar school in the state. We have to go out. Every student has to be tested by grade level. They have to be done eyeball-to-eyeball for your TESA and your writing. And we try to have, we have people going out who are certified teachers, and they monitor the test eyeball-to-eyeball, and we try to be within 50 miles of any student. So, I mean, we do take it seriously. We do our best to meet all the state standards, and we're very proud of our program. In terms of the economics, you know, we have a good many of our teachers that are working in SIO. They spend their money in SIO. They rent the building in SIO. But brick and mortar, having been a superintendent, you know, we didn't always buy our textbooks downtown Portland, or didn't buy our bus transportation necessarily in the state of Oregon. So, you know, there's the economics that can go either way. Sometimes you do, sometimes you don't. It's a diverse expenditures in terms of your funds, where you spend them. But we do get try to get the best that we can in terms of the best of the breed textbooks. You know, about 60% of our students were formerly homeschooled or private schooled in a program. Okay, and I like to think that we do our best to make sure that no child is left behind. We want them to get in our program and be a part of that program and be successful in our program. So, you know, so this aspect of the 50% of the students required to be in the home district is a death blow to the Oregon Connections Academy, and I strongly would urge you to you know, send this out of committee and let's get it to the floor so we can take care of this issue. And you know, competition is a good thing. You know, we're not afraid of it. I think it's something that you know, is good for students. It provides alternatives for our, for education, and we'd like to think that you know, we can hold our own on that as well as provide a quality education. Questions? I'd be happy to answer, Madam Chairman.
Matt, did you want to speak first before we do questions?
Sure, that'd be great.
Okay. Because just that you know, we have there's a committee that meets here right after ours, and so we really need to be out of here at the absolute latest, 5 till, but 10 till would be best.
Okay, I'll be brief.
Thank you.
For the record, my name is Matt Wingard. I'm the media outreach coordinator for Oregon Connections Academy. I've been affiliated with them now for a little over 2 years. And I wanted to briefly tell this story about what happened in the summer of 2005. They asked me very late, I think it was about July of 2005, because contract negotiations had gone a little bit longer within SIO, and they weren't sure if they were going to be opening up in the fall. So I got the notice in July that they did intend to open in the fall, and they wanted me to very rapidly put together informational sessions around the state. So I was to find hotel rooms, and there would be some mailings that would go out and some radio ads telling people that they could come and learn about this school. Now, this is an Connections Academy operates, or at least at that time it operated, was operating in 9 other states, and so Oregon was their 10th state, and so they had a little bit of history in kind of how these things go, and I asked for some guidance about space and everything, and they said, well, you can expect about 25 people, usually 25 to 30 people, to show up at one of these meetings. So I dutifully, and I spent many hours reserving rooms that could fit 25 to 30 people at these hotels and community centers where we and public libraries where we reserved space. Our very first meeting was at the Red Lion in Hillsboro, right next to the airport. And 15 minutes before the event was going to start, we were already over 50 people, and they were arriving about 2 or so every 10 seconds. I ended up begging the hotel to allow us to go to a room that they'd already set up for another event in the morning. And we had over 100 parents and students attend that very first informational session about how they could access this school. That turned out to be a leading indicator of how every information session would go, and we did 19 of them around the state in Portland and Beaverton, Hillsboro, Gresham, Oregon City, Salem, Seaside, Coos Bay. We were in Springfield, Grants Pass, Ashland, Klamath Falls, Bend, Pendleton, Ontario. And we had overflow capacities. Luckily, at that point, I called ahead and began reserving larger rooms because I knew what we were, I could then judge what we were in for. We had over 1,000 applications for the school. And these are people who are finding out about it 30 to 40 days before it is going to open. And we ended up, at the time, the district didn't want us to go past 500. So we ended up having to tell a lot of people that we could not offer the option to them this fall. Many of them returned, waited until we opened up enrollment again in April and May, and applied at that time. And this year, starting in the fall, for our second year, we have 1,500 students attending the school. And the word is spreading. And I tell that story simply to try to articulate the demand for a different option, a different educational option out there that we weren't even fully prepared for when we put out the word for people that the school was available to them. So we're doing our best to meet that demand. The idea that 5 years from now, after the school has grown even a little bit more, that we would just shut it down and tell all of these parents and students that they're going to have to go find some other educational option for themselves. Even though they love this school, they are invested in it and dedicated to it, and they want to graduate from Connections Academy, it is really mind-boggling to me. We held this idea of socialization and whether or not people disappear. We held an event in SIO in October, which was just meant to be a fair for our parents and students. And remember that our students are all over the state. They are basically geographically representative of the population of the state. That's how spread out they are. It's almost a perfect overlay. So you have 1,500 students. We held a fair in SIO, which is fairly much the center of the state, and we had over 1,000 of our students attend that fair. They drove from all over the state to be there for that day's activities, and it was just a fun day of activities, but they came out for that. That's how dedicated they are to the school and how wedded they are to it, and how much they wanted to participate and meet other students who are attending, and the parents wanted to talk to other parents, and the students, in some cases, wanted to meet their teachers in person. I was struck by that moment in Hillsborough at the Red Lion, and it dawned on me. I'm a fourth generation Oregonian myself, and it's very typical of Oregonians. We are innovators. We want things outside the box. We want options, choices, flexibility, and I would urge this committee to take Jim Thomas up on his offer to come out to SIO and see how this school operates. And I'm convinced that within a few minutes, you will understand why so many parents and students love this school and why they are our best salespeople for increasing the enrollment. They are the ones who tell their friends and neighbors about this option and produce people who fill out applications and want to join. So I would urge you to take him up on that and to move this bill out. This was not language that Oregon Connections Academy asked for. This is not something that parents and students want to see remain as language in statute. And we'd be happy to provide those 1,500 people for you, if you'd like, to tell you exactly why they'd like to have that language removed from statute.
I'd just like to add one thing. We did have two members of the State Board of Education last year come out and take a look at our program, along with Vicki Fleming, who at the time was the Assistant Superintendent of Public Instruction, and they made the statement at their board meeting that we had an amazing program.
Rather than ask these gentlemen a rigorous load of questions, is there interest by the committee members to go visit the school?
Yes, very much.
Let's go.
Get on the bus.
It's not. I just wrote a note from Gene. He said I could vote for him. He'd like to go too.
Okay. Representative Wisnett is, in spirit here, obviously. Well, we'll take you up on your offer.
Thank you very much. I mean, that way you can see for yourselves.
And ask you all kinds of questions.
Hey, love 20 questions.
Okay.
Sometimes.
We love showing off the school. So.
Most of us educators do like to do that. You can come to any school in the state and you have, the same response. So, but I understand your pride.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you for your testimony. Any other comments before we leave this public work session?
Just thank you, Madam Chair, for holding this. It's been very interesting.
Okay. Representative Minnis?
I think the suggestion that we go down and actually have a look at it and really helps us instead of an abstract opinion. We can go down and look at it ourselves and see what it's all about. I think it's an excellent suggestion.
Thank you. Thank you. Representative Minnis. Okay, well,
for your excellent suggestion.
Never mind. We're on camera. I'm going to close the public hearing. And visit, and Sile's not very far away, so it wouldn't take, you know, too much time out of our day. So, okay. That'll close our hearing today for the Subcommittee on Education Innovation.